Okay, so it seems now the Numenoreans have really fallen off a cliff, jumped off the precipice. If within 3 years, Sauron goes from prisoner to top counselor, it's pretty bad. How dumb can you get? All right, Clifford, we're back again.
Indeed we are.
Okay, what are we doing today? We gotta keep this quick. We're on a time schedule today.
I know. We are wrapping up this special tale of Numenor today.
Oh.
And
fairy tale happy ending?
No, not quite.
Don't spoil it.
Well, actually, did we give the title of this whole narrative, this whole chapter? At the beginning, the section is called "The Downfall of Numenor."
Yeah, so, the Akalabeth. Yeah.
Yes. Anyways, following up to the last few episodes, this is the end of things for Numenor.
Okay. You want to walk us through what's happened so far, just real briefly?
Yeah. So we learned about the island of Numenor, which was the special island formed out of the middle of the ocean by the Valar, 2/3 of the way between what we know as Middle Earth and Valinor, where the Valar live. And it was formed as basically a reward for a few tribes of men who fought very valiantly with the elves and the Valar against Morgoth in the Great Battle in Middle Earth. So they sailed there. It's this island empire. They are friends with the elves. They're like basically the good guys. They're the best men. They have a ban that says you can sail east, but you can't sail west. You can't come any closer to Valinor because you're already pretty close already. Valinor is for the elves and the Valar only. And men are okay with that for a while, but eventually they start to get a little bit impatient and curious and start to think about mortality and that maybe if they could go to Valinor, they would be immortal too. So things start to spiral downhill from there. And basically that pride that they deserve immortality starts to undermine their entire society.
Yeah.
And they quickly turn into kind of a tyranny. And that's roughly where we left things, I'd say.
Yeah, it's... What about for like 2 minutes? What if we try to... how does this tie into the Finrod and Andreth conversation, which at this point was recorded quite a while ago?
So basically... Finrod and Andreth were talking about if men deserve to die or if they're supposed to die or if it was an accident, kind of like they are well aware that elves have immortality. They can live forever unless they get killed. And obviously the Valar are like the gods, kind of. They can live forever, or they're not really mortal in the same way. Men are mortal though and have defined lifespans, but that mortality is referred to as the gift of Iluvatar, right?
Yeah. Well, the gift. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Finrod, who's an elf, is kind of saying, hey, you guys have it pretty good. You get to leave the world, and probably, maybe, there's something going on for you beyond the world in the future. We don't really know. Whereas us elves, we're really tied to this planet. Like, we might be able to live forever, but we're totally stuck here. And Andreth, meanwhile, thinks, like, okay, maybe so, but I'm pretty sure that men get to live forever, and it's a mistake or a corruption that they're being killed off at a certain defined period of time. And so, you like, right away, you can imagine if somebody thinks they're supposed to be living forever, but they're not, total, like, Andrith, and then clearly some of the men in Numenor think they're being totally wronged.
Yeah. So I think like the men of Numenor have taken the despair of death to its most utter, furthest possible end. We kind of saw that towards the end of the last episode, and we'll see that again tonight as we do this, because where we exactly left off was everything Clifford had said, but then by this point, everybody was openly upset with the Valar, or almost everybody. There's still the remnant of the faithful people, but the kings are openly rebelling against the Valar and even the elves. And then there was one good king that somehow came up right towards the end here, but he died without a son. And then his super evil nephew, Ar-Pharazôn, he forcefully married the good king's daughter, so his first cousin, to make himself the king, and he's just by far the worst of all of them. And we were just meeting him, but it's going to continue here, because he was so powerful, he went back to Middle-earth to fight Sauron, but instead, Sauron, being kind of tricksy and wily, comes out to Ar-Pharazôn and just allows himself to be taken prisoner and brought back to Numenor. And that's basically where we left off here. One other thing I forgot to mention from the last episode. You were talking about how this sounds like Egypt, and I totally agree with you, and we're going to see more references to that tonight. But the other way that this thing reads, it reads like the Book of Kings in the Bible.
Okay.
It starts off with King David on the throne, and he was the best king. It goes through Solomon and then through the other ones as well. And progressively, all the kings get worse and worse. Like most of them, they fall into idolatry and pagan worship. And so, you know, the Bible goes through generation by generation. All right, this king was good, this king was bad, you know. But it was kind of a similar thing to what we did last episode. And now this is the culmination of it. And then the Book of Kings also had a culmination at the end of that as well. So we'll see a little bit of parallels too. But yeah.
Okay.
Cool. But anyways, yeah, we ended with Sauron coming back to Middle-earth. You want to take that first quoted section?
Sure. And Sauron passed over the sea and looked upon the land of Numenor and on the city of Armenelos in the days of its glory, and he was astounded, but his heart was filled the more with envy and hate. Yet such was the cunning of his mind and mouth and the strength of his hidden will that ere 3 years had passed, he had become closest to the secret counsels of the king. For flattery sweet as honey was ever on his tongue, and knowledge he had of many things yet unrevealed to men. And seeing the favor that he had of their lord, all the counselors began to fawn upon him, save one alone, Amandil, lord of Anduine. Then slowly a change came over the land, and the hearts of the elf friends were sorely troubled, and many fell away out of fear. And although those that remained still called themselves the faithful, their enemies named them rebels. For now, having the ears of men, Sauron, with many arguments, gainsaid all that the Valar had taught, and he bade men think that in the world, in the east and even high in the west, there lay yet many seas and many lands for their winning, wherein was wealth uncounted.
Okay, so it seems now the Numenoreans have really fallen off a cliff, jumped off the precipice, if within 3 years... Sauron goes from prisoner to top counselor.
Yes.
How dumb can you get?
And it sounds a little bit similar to Wormtongue in Rohan.
Yeah.
Maybe a more intense version of that, but this outsider kind of weasels his way in, and then all of a sudden is steering the direction of the entire kingdom.
Yeah, except the one guy, this Amandil guy, who's part of that house, the good house, the lords of the Anduni. They were the one we talked about them last time. They are historically, they're a lesser branch of royalty, and they're historically have been the leaders of the faithful people, basically. Though not super openly. Yeah.
Right.
But yeah, I'll talk about it in a little bit, but I've picked up a real world connection as well. There's like a bunch of real world connections you can pick up with all of these, but whenever you have them off the top of your head, Clifford, mention them, because I got a couple here. So.
Okay.
All right, but the corruption gets even worse. Do you want to take Sauron and I'll take Ar-Pharazôn?
Sure.
Because you're more like Sauron and I'm more like Ar-Pharazôn.
Is that a compliment or an insult? I don't really know.
I think I would actually take it as a compliment. Our Farazan's an idiot.
Okay, well, thank you. Okay. Sauron, with his many arguments, gainsayed all that the Valar had taught, and he bade men think that in the world, in the east, and even high in the west, there lay yet many seas and many lands for their winning, wherein was wealth uncounted. And still, if they should at last come to the end of those lands and seas, beyond all lay the ancient darkness, and out of it the world was made. For darkness alone is worshipful, and the Lord thereof may yet make other worlds to be gifts to those that serve him, so that the increase of their power shall find no end.
And Ar-Pharazôn said, "Who is the Lord of the darkness?"
Then behind locked doors, Sauron spoke to the king, and he lied, saying, "It is he whose name is not now spoken, for the Valar have deceived you concerning him, putting forward the name of Eru, a phantom devised only in the folly of their hearts, seeking to enchain men in servitude to themselves. For they are the oracle of this Eru, which speaks only what they will. But he that is their master shall yet prevail, and he will deliver you from this phantom. And his name is Melkor, Lord of all, giver of freedom, and he shall make you stronger than they."
Oh boy. All right, your thoughts first.
So, I mean, this is... Yeah, I like the real depths of Ar-Pharazôn's descent and Numenor's descent.
Yeah.
And maybe the culmination in a just a few lines. Basically, Sauron is like, "Yeah, if you're power hungry, like, I'm your guy. I'm the one you need to talk to about endless power, and everything else you've been told is a lie. Those Valar, they're jokers. You don't need to trust them, and I can deliver everything that you have ever dreamed."
So, I mean, he basically goes so far to say, does he explicitly say it, that Eru Iluvatar doesn't even exist?
Yeah, he says he's a phantom, and that basically the Valar, the reason like you only hear about him from the Valar is because the Valar made him up, and they're just saying, this guy said something, therefore you have to follow it.
Yeah. Okay, so in the context of the Silmarillion, this sounds really, really, really dumb, right? But, but I mean, if you actually think about it, especially if you compare it to our world, since Numenor has been around by this point actually for 2,500 years probably, about that, maybe a little bit longer. So that's actually, I mean, compared to our time, that goes back to Aristotle. Mm-hmm. That's how far back it was. And so it's still unbelievable that you just reject and not even believe in Eru Iluvatar. But at the same time, you know, there's people today where that's a huge question, whether you like, you know, God's existence or not. That's one of the ultimate questions and debates nowadays. So I guess putting it in that context, maybe it's not that ridiculous for them. They did have a longer lifespan, so it's not as many generations away, but still, I mean, they have the Valar and everything, but it's still, I don't know. In our context, potentially this is actually kind of reasonable.
You're saying because the people of Numenor had like more or less direct interaction with the Valar.
It should be less earlier. Yeah.
And they've basically forgotten that and are saying like, "Oh, well, we don't even know them that well. They're hiding stuff from us."
Well, there's no way they really even forget it. They have to kind of be rejecting it, I would think. You know, they have good record, you know, like they did good record keeping, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess here they're also, they like, Sauron's not telling them that Valar aren't real, just that Eru isn't real. So,
yeah.
And they would never have seen Eru or talked to Eru, right?
Right. And from when you read the book, though, even that one sounds stupid. But then if you compare it to our world, well, that's actually highly up for debate.
Yeah, fair.
Yeah. Okay, what also sounds dumb is that Sauron says Melkor can deliver the people from this phantom Eru, which just extremely, extremely dumb, because they know that the island of Numenor was their reward for helping fight against Sauron and Melkor. I mean, it's just, it's ridiculous that Sauron's getting this guy to think Melkor was actually the good guy. It's nuts. But again, compared to our world today, all those people who don't believe in God, you know, they all have to try to rely on something else to replace him, you know, whether it's like science or I don't know, definitely in the past, probably in the present, and actually in the present too. there's been, you know, some sort of government quest to perfection of some kind, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I feel like the pretty clearly just the promise that he's like, yeah, I can solve all your problems. I can give you anything you want, yeah, liberate you from anything. Is just, I don't know. It stinks.
Yeah. For sure. Yeah. So Arpharazon then openly starts worshiping Melkor, to which I have to assume, you know, you'd have to assume, or the expression would totally hold true, Elros, Tur, Beren, and Luthien, they must all be rolling in their graves, mm-hmm, you know, if they saw this. This is ridiculous. This is what the heirs of Eärendil and Elwing are doing. I mean, that's, and Eärendil and Elwing, I mean, they're out there, you know. I mean, Eärendil's flying in the boat still up in the, mm-hmm, sky. I mean, he could potentially see this stuff, and it's just, oh, must be heartbreaking, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But there is still the faithful remnant led by this Amandil guy, and his son is Elendil. We've heard that name before, right? And yes, we've definitely heard his sons, Isildur and Anarion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one cool thing, Elendil literally translates to elf friend, which is a pretty bold name to hold.
Definitely.
At this time. Yeah. But it's a classic case, too, where Amandil, you know, he used to be really good buds with Arpharazon when they were younger, even though they were both part of different factions, but I guess they grew up together. You know, all the nobility probably, mm-hmm, go to the same school, right? Mm-hmm. And Arpharazon, he still even kept him as a counselor. But classic fashion, Sauron drove a wedge between them. And of course, Sauron hated Amandil and his family above all others, you know. But he, Amandil, was so noble and had been so mighty a captain of the sea that he was still held in honor by many of the people, and neither the king nor Sauron dared to lay hands on him as yet. But then from there, it keeps getting worse. Arpharazon and Sauron, they banned everyone upon pain of death from going up to the mountaintop, which was supposed to be the sanctuary for Eru Iluvatar, you know, the one, mm-hmm, god, the good god. All the faithful, they end up hanging out in this place called Romana.
Romana?
Romana.
Yeah.
You think that's a reference to that Ravenna place in Italy?
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing, actually.
I don't know if what the architecture would be or if Ravenna was a hideout, but it's near Ravenna, Venice.
Yeah, it's. I think I actually went there. It was like a Roman outpost.
You forget if you went there?
No, I think I did go there. I didn't. it was very briefly, but yeah, I've been there. It was really cool.
Yeah, they have. It's like late Roman Empire, right? This is, yeah, what they're known, yeah, for, their architecture stuff.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I think they have an old bridge there that's from the Roman Empire.
I think what they have, some sort of famous chapel. I don't know if it's like a cathedral or anything, but it's kind of like the cross between Greek and Roman, you know, like East and West.
Yes. I think it's, they also have what is like the first, considered one of the first churches of the Renaissance, of Renaissance architecture.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, that place has been around for a while, so.
Anyways, yeah.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to have... can we jump off from there? Or is this just random? Sure.
No, yeah, we can keep going. I was going to say, the name did make me think of the same thing as well.
Mm-hmm.
As like this outpost from the main place.
Yeah.
Late empire. Maybe the empire's crumbling. Mm. Something like that.
All right, so Sauron, Sauron also advises Arpharazon to cut down the white tree Nimloth, and that's the big white tree that's on this island. It's from the tree that's on the Lonely Isle, Tol Arisia, you know, and that seedling's from Telperion, which was the silver tree of the two trees. We've, mm-hmm, actually gone over this in the Token and the Eucharist special. We talked about all the trees and, mm-hmm, just went straight shot through them all. But remember, if we remember from the last episode, that last good king, he had prophesied that when the white tree of Numenor is destroyed, then the line of Numenorean kings will also end too.
Mm-hmm.
So, Clifford, I'm going to give you the honor. You get to read the coolest part, the best, the silver lining of this episode.
Okay. So, at the first, the king would not assent to this, since he believed that the fortunes of his house were bound up with the tree, as was forespoken by Tar Palantir. Thus, in his folly, he who now hated the Eldar and the Valar vainly clung to the shadow of the old allegiance of Numenor. But when Amandiel heard rumor of the evil purpose of Sauron, he was grieved to the heart, knowing that in the end Sauron would surely have his will. Then he spoke to Elendil and the sons of Elendil, recalling the tale of the trees of Valinor, and Isildur said no word, but went out by night and did a deed for which he was afterwards renowned. For he passed alone in disguise to Armenelos and to the courts of the king, which were now forbidden to the faithful, and he came to the place of the tree, which was forbidden to all by the orders of Sauron. And the tree was watched day and night by guards in his service. At that time Nimloth was dark and bore no bloom, for it was late in the autumn, and its winter was nigh. And Isildur passed through the guards and took from the tree a fruit that hung upon it, and turned to go. But the guard was aroused, and he was assailed, and fought its way out, receiving many wounds. And he escaped, and because he was disguised, it was not discovered who had laid hands on the tree. But Isildur came at last hardly back to Ramenna, and delivered the fruit to the hands of Amandiel, ere his strength failed him. Then the fruit was planted in secret, and it was blessed by Amandiel, and a shoot arose from it, and it sprouted in the spring. But when its first leaf opened, then Isildur, who had lain long and come near to death, arose and was troubled no more by his wounds.
Alright, that's pretty sweet, pretty sick. So, I guess, you know what I forgot? This is, pay close attention, because this is what this new Amazon Lord of the Rings show is going to be about. It's going to be mostly focused on Numenor. Yeah, it's the Second Age. So it's this stuff, and then it's probably fighting Sauron in Middle-earth as well, which we've already gone over with the Galadriel special.
Okay.
But I don't know. I don't actually have high hopes for that show. Not going to lie. That's just it. You know, hopefully it's watchable, because there's been Star Wars things that have been unwatchable. So that's pretty unbelievable. But yeah, so I'm hoping this will probably be a really cool scene in the show when they eventually get to it. I would assume whatever it is, it won't be in the first season, but you know, this should be pretty sick. And I was also thinking this would be such a sweet video game level, you know.
Retrieve the fruit from the tree.
Well, I mean, no, they said he gets assailed. So, I mean, it's, you know, every single time you're doing Call of Duty and it's just, you know, it's just you versus 50 billion of the enemy people. I mean, that's not accurate. That's not how World War II worked, you know.
Right,
I mean,
right.
You maneuvered to the side, but you had at least 10 people with you versus, you know, an equal force. But here, this is just one guy. He's in disguise, you know, and he sneaks into the castle, and seems like he's literally got to fight his way out because he was on death's door by the time he got back because he was so wounded. That's pretty sick. That would be a cool level, yeah.
And I would like to play that. He risks everything, and then just like that, the prophecy of the kind of the life of the tree being tied to this line of kings. Mm. He comes back when the tree makes a comeback, right?
Well, so
I know it's not exactly that.
Quite right. That, yeah. He saved the seed and then sprouted a new tree. And so, yeah, his life is bound to that tree. And so will his future kingdom be.
Right. Right.
Yeah. All right. Soon after that, though, Arfar is uncaved and he followed Sauron's idea to destroy the white tree. So it was good timing on Isildur's part. In its place, Sauron makes this massive temple. So let me read about this. But Sauron caused to be built upon the hill in the midst of the city of the Numenorians, Armenelos the Golden, a mighty temple. And it was in the form of a circle at the base. And there the walls were 50 feet in thickness, and the width of the base was 500 feet across the center. And the walls rose from the ground 500 feet, and they were crowned with a mighty dome. And that dome was roofed all with silver, and rose glittering in the sun, so that the light of it could be seen from afar. But soon the light was darkened, and the silver became black. And there was an altar of fire in the midst of the temple, and in the topmost of the dome there was a louver. Louver?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Whence there issued a great smoke, and the first fire upon the altar Sauron kindled with the hewn wood of Nimloth, and it crackled and was consumed. But men marveled at the reek that went up from it, so that the land lay under a cloud for 7 days, until slowly it passed into the west.
So he, like, consecrated the temple by burning the tree.
Yeah, it was pretty bad. All right, so lots of dome temples, right? There's lots of cathedrals. Lots of U.S. capitals use a dome, right? Uh-huh. Obviously, there's the Vatican, which is probably maybe the most famous dome. I guess it's got the louver means a hole in the middle, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of funny. I've been doing a bunch of details at work related to louvers for ventilation. I realize that's like a total jargon word in architecture. But yeah, it's like a vent for letting out air, letting in air.
So I guess the one that most would be like that really exists is the Pantheon then, right?
In Rome. Yeah, the Pantheon is a really good example with the oculus up at the top.
But I think I might have read somewhere what he had in mind, which is kind of weird because this was never actually built, but it was planned. The Nazis planned some huge dome in Berlin, the Volkshalle.
Okay.
I don't know. What do you know about it? I put a picture up.
I have heard about this, but I don't know much about it at all.
Anyways, it looks evil. If you look it up, how do you spell Volkshalle?
Volkshalle. Like people's.
Volkshalle.
It's
okay.
German for folks and then hall.
Mm. Okay. So Volkshalle.
Yeah.
Yeah. Check that out. That's a, I don't know, maybe.
Oh, you know what? It looks like they rendered it or did something for Man in the High Castle, which is a movie or a TV show.
Book. I watched the first season of that.
Okay, I didn't see any of it. But yeah, it looks like they've got it depicted there. Crazy.
Yeah, so would this have ruined... Wait. I know you're on the spot, but try to look up where it would have been. Would it have ruined, like, Berlin? Would it have just been smack dab in the middle and just thrown off the whole city plan? Or would it actually look good?
I'm guessing that they probably would have demolished a ton of stuff to put it in.
Yeah.
Unsurprisingly. But it looks like all these images, like, they're maintaining some sort of monumental axis. Like, real, like, you know, kind of old school Renaissance planning. A lot of the Nazi architecture is pretty weird in that, or I don't know how to describe it. It's like a version of neoclassicism.
Wait. All right. Since we're on topic.
Okay.
And it's Nazis. They were in the 30s and then the 40s.
Uh-huh.
But that's when Art Deco was going on too. Was that only an American thing or is that?
No. Art Deco was like Art Deco and kind of some related stuff was in Europe as well.
Because Chicago Board of Trade is what I think of when I think of Art Deco and Empire State Building.
Yeah,
those are Art Deco. Okay, so this seems a more evil version of that.
Yeah, when I look at it. Definitely related.
Or imperial if you don't want to do good and evil, but you know, right. Nazis were evil, right? So
right, but it draws a lot of inspiration from classical architecture, definitely. Like. Especially at the time, like by this time, they're starting like early modern stuff like steel and glass, and the Nazi architecture was like big time into like pillars with pediments and like big stone symmetrical architecture in the type that you see in classical architecture, but at like a totally different scale. They definitely understood the, basically like the resonance that classical architecture had for like imperial power and like the even just something simple like symmetry, like a big plaza that's symmetrical, which shows up all over like almost all classical architecture or a lot of classical architecture is symmetrical. They used a lot of that.
Interesting.
Yeah. One other thing that came to mind just in that description of it being like the same width as the height. I guess there's actually a couple, there's some different like idea that the Volkshalle you pulled up looks like it's proportionally about that, but the pyramids in Giza are also, I might have that wrong actually. They might be double the width as they are tall. Sorry, we're going off into a rabbit hole. Something else to look up, this is a completely imaginary project, but look up Newton's Cenotaph. It's by an architect named Etienne Boulay.
Newton's. Wait, how do you spell cenotaph?
C-E-N-O.
C-E-N-O.
T-A-P-H.
T-A-O-P-H. Huh?
Yeah, and this was basically a mausoleum that this guy proposed for Newton, for Isaac Newton.
Whoa.
It was like, you know, so fantastical. It was never a real proposal at all, but he was like, how do you make an adequate monument, tomb for the guy who, like, completely changed modern physics? And so he proposed this giant sphere made out of stone that would be, like, kind of like a pyramid, like, accessed by a really tiny tunnel. Minuscule space, you come up a stair.
Well, it's kind of like a pyramid, besides that it's a sphere. You know, it's like, right. it's a pyramid in spirit, but it's a...
But then it's hollow.
Exact opposite. Right, it's the
And
exact
then you go
opposite.
Inside, and the outside would be punctured with, like, a planetarium, like, holes to correspond to the stars.
Yeah.
Totally wild. but we studied this one in architecture school. Anyways, I could imagine the temple being described here looking something kind of like this, with, like, the super strong circular base.
Interesting. Yeah. All right, well, yeah, let's keep moving. Okay. What were they doing in this temple, Clifford? You want to read the fire and smoke were always burning from the temple, and then you want to take that?
Yeah. With spilling of blood and torment and great wickedness, men made sacrifice to Melkor that he should release them from death. And most often, from among the faithful, they chose their victims, yet never openly on the charge that they would not worship Melkor, the giver of freedom. Rather was cause sought against them that they hated the king and were his rebels.
Okay, so they are sacrificing the faithful people to the Eldar, or sorry, the faithful people to the Valar, as human sacrifices so that Melkor can release them from death. Winning strategy.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Also, notably, they're like not even kind of owning up to it. It's like they're still embarrassed about their actions, basically. So they're,
yeah.
It sounds like basically taking the faithful, the so-called rebels, on like political prisoner charges,
yeah,
and then sacrificing them and not even acknowledging that it's just like this purely,
well,
like, worship of darkness thing.
Yeah, so that'll be important in a couple of minutes here. They're called the rebels in quotes, but they don't actually rebel against the king. They're just still friends with the Valar. They're totally right. Loyal to the king by this point, but they're still also friends with the Valar, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And just FYI for everybody, human sacrifice at every point in history is bad. Don't side with idol worshippers. We don't need them. We're glad that most of that has been extinguished from the earth. So, and yeah.
Just... Message from Patrick. When you come across the human sacrifice,
you should actually do what you can in your power to stop it. Yeah. Because, you know, at some points in history, I think it was actually demonic, you know, like here, this is demonic. They're worshiping Melkor. I mean, that's bad. There's other stuff like, yeah, that's potentially, it really was a real bona fide demon. And by bona fide, that means good fortune, good something. Good. What does bona fide mean?
It means like good, real, like
good. Yeah.
Actually.
Bona means good, right?
Yeah. But it means like. Kind of
okay.
Like credentials.
I'll cut this part out. Okay.
Bonafide demon, yeah. Means like
yeah.
Definitely
real deal.
De facto demon.
Okay. All right. Let's see. But for all this, death did not depart from the land. Rather, it came sooner and more often, and in many dreadful guises. For whereas aforetime men had grown slowly old and had laid them down in the end to sleep, when they were weary at last of the world, now madness and sickness assailed them. And men took weapons in those days and slew one another for little cause, for they were become quick to anger. And Sauron, or those whom he had bound to himself, went about the land setting man against man. Okay, so I get Sauron's evil. I get that he's jealous of Numenor and everything, but I still don't quite understand how he can really just enjoy seeing this place just go to shit. You're literally watching this civilization commit suicide. This is really bad.
Didn't we get a glimpse from the very when he was introduced to this story that he just wanted to see them destroyed because they were clearly strong and powerful and the Valar loved them?
Yeah, but it's still, it's just because he's also putting on a fair appearance here too. I mean, just it was a very beautiful place, you know, aesthetically pleasing place. How do you just enjoy watching it? You know, big, huge temple that's ugly and always burning, you know, reeking. You know, the smoke coming up, too. This can also, they're explicitly saying it's a temple, but I mean, also concentration camp stuff, you know, smoke is rising from those suckers. But, I mean, it's just, I don't know. It's one thing you hate them and you want them destroyed and everything, but then you want the whole beautiful place destroyed, too. I mean, I know he's evil, but I think he could still actually appreciate stuff that.
Yeah.
You know, looks good.
maybe not.
Yeah, maybe he's that corrupt. But
I mean, we heard when he was coming over on the boat for the first time, he saw how beautiful the place actually was, but it just made him hate it more.
Right. Yeah.
He hates anything good and anything that's powerful that he doesn't have. Basically.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a shame, loser. Nonetheless, for a long time, it seemed to the Numenoreans that they prospered. And if they were not increased in happiness, they grew more strong, and their rich men ever richer. For with the aid and counsel of Sauron, they multiplied then possessions, and they devised engines, and they built ever greater ships, and they sailed now with power and the armory to Middle-earth. And they came no longer as bringers of gift, nor even as rulers, but as fierce men of war. So I guess that somewhat starts to help explain a little bit that he's also helping, you know, it's probably not looking as, it's not like blood in the streets completely yet, you know.
But. Right, right.
And then he's also helping them profit.
It looks like progress in the right light, basically.
Yeah, yeah. Also, potentially eerily similar to world events in the past couple generations.
Industrial Revolution?
Yeah, just... and if they were not increased in happiness, they grew more strong and the rich men ever richer. I mean, yeah, everybody's becoming richer, but yeah, is anybody getting happier?
Right.
It's highly questionable. Yeah.
Agreed.
The ships too. I don't quite think they're steamships, but I do imagine them kind of being made out of metal, which again, like Industrial Revolution, you know, the first metal iron warships, right? But
right.
But they say later that they still have a bunch of oars. So I guess
it's possible when he says they devised engines that it's not actually like what we would consider like internal combustion engine, but it's like just a slightly higher level of mechanization.
Well,
also some other times, like in other, I think in elsewhere in Lord of the Rings, but in other writing, the term siege engines comes up. Like a siege engine is like one of those big, like battering ram things, or like a trebuchet catapult.
Yeah,
I think that's sometimes called a siege engine. So even though we wouldn't think of it as an engine, it would qualify here.
What about in the context of ships, the steamboats with the wheel on the back? That takes an engine.
Yeah. Is powering pistons, so it's like burning coal to boil water, and then the force of the steam is like pushing some type of piston. So that's what's creating the power.
Okay, so you don't think they can do that yet?
Well, just the word engines, maybe, but then yeah, if they have oars later on, it seems a little bit improbable. Also, that'd be like way more advanced than any technology anywhere else in Lord of the Rings, right?
I don't know.
Until maybe we get to, like, Saruman's place.
Right, correct. Saruman, yeah.
Yeah, but it seems a little bit, like, a little bit too much. Too much too fast.
Okay, fine. It's fine.
But we get the
though,
point.
Though, we also saw way back in 1917 in the Siege of Gondor, or Gondolin, there was tanks, you know, they were dragons, but they were like metal. And it was like, this is really a tank, you know, that was the first thing I ever wrote though. So that probably really doesn't line up whatsoever.
Yeah. Okay.
But there have been, I think there have been, you know, metal beast things, you know.
Well, yeah, clearly they know how to work metal.
Yeah.
Well, okay. I mean, we could say they have some engines. They don't have guns, right?
No.
Are cannons. Well,
they got bows and arrows. Those are way sicker.
I know. Yeah. From like a true chronology standpoint, like gunpowder shows up well before engines, right?
Well, there's gunpowder at Helm's Deep because they blow up the wall.
Oh, true.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyways.
So they're getting right to that point. Yeah. Dude, I never knew. Well, now we're really getting off track, but let me just say it just because I brought it up. I always thought supposedly maybe the Chinese invented the gun, but the Turks really perfected it. Mm-hmm. But they really had the cannons first. And I thought they had, you know, really crappy muskets when they took over Constantinople, you know, because mm-hmm. that's like 1453. Like that's when basically the Renaissance starts. Uh-huh. But they just had giant, giant, giant cannons and they just blew up the walls. And it's like,
that's wild.
Yeah, that was wild. Yeah. I saw like a Netflix little mini series on it. It was the only thing that ever caught my eye, and I just watched, and it's just, dude, that's
wild.
Yeah, yeah. Like they didn't have wheels on the cannons. You know, you just had to like rope them up and place them where you wanted, and then put them on a ship. Maybe, you know. I mean,
I feel like it's like technology wise, it's probably like basically just like taking like a cup, filling it with something explosive and putting a thing on one side of it and just hoping that it explodes in the right direction.
Yeah, a couple of them in the show totally blew up. I'm sure they blew up in real life, you know, because there's a crack, you know.
Right, so
that screwed it all up. Yeah. All right, you want to take whatever Ar-Pharazôn does next year?
Mm-hmm. Thus Ar-Pharazôn, king of the land of the star, grew to the mightiest tyrant that had yet been in the world since the reign of Morgoth, though in truth Sauron ruled all from behind the throne. But the years passed, and the king felt the shadow of death approach as his days lengthened, and he was filled with fear and wrath. Now came the hour that Sauron had prepared and long had awaited, and Sauron spoke to the king, saying that his strength was now so great that he might think to have his will in all things, and be subject to no command or ban. And he said, "The Valar have possessed themselves of the land where there is no death, and they lie to you concerning it, hiding it as best they may, because of their avarice and their fear lest the kings of men should wrest it from them, the deathless realm, and rule the world in their stead. And though, doubtless, the gift of life unending is not for all, but only for such as are worthy, being men of might and pride and great lineage, yet against all justice it is done that this gift, which is his due, should be withheld from the king of Bangs, Ar-Pharazôn, mightiest of the sons of earth, to whom Manwë alone can be compared, if even he. But great kings do not brook denials, and take what is their due." Then Ar-Pharazôn, being besotted, and walking under the shadow of death, for his span was drawing towards its end, hearkened to Sauron, and he began to ponder in his heart how he might make war upon the Valar.
All right, another boneheaded move.
Yeah, bad news bears.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so this kind of, I couldn't, this has to be common, because I remember, you know, this is something you see in the movies, where the rich old man leader kind of, you know, completely goes on a personal mission for immortality, mm-hmm. especially when it's crunch time when they're old, you know, because now we don't have much time left. We got to get this done or else I'm going to die before it even gets done.
Right.
The first movie that came to mind, because it's the only one I can even remember, but did you see that Prometheus movie? It came out in like 2012.
I remember seeing previews for it, but I never watched it.
Yeah, we would have been in high school, but
yeah, I think I saw trailers.
It's some sort of prequel for Alien, you know, Alien okay. vs. Predator, you know, all that stuff. Anyways, there was something. They go to this planet, you know, and their expedition was paid for by some rich trillionaire back on Earth or something. But then there was one scene in the movie. It's about the only thing I even remember from it. But he, towards the end, this is a big spoiler for the movie, but it's not a big deal because nobody's gonna watch this. They go to this one secret room on the ship that nobody had been on, and then it turns out that the old man had, you know, frozen himself, and then he was waking up from like the whole long journey because he was on this planet, and the whole reason they were on this planet was to try to find some elixir of life to give immortality, and he was there, you know, that's why he funded this whole trip, because he's ancient. I mean, this guy's like 100, you know, and he was trying to get there and get the, I don't know, it reminded me of Arfars on here, and I feel like there's got to be other examples in movies that I'm just not remembering.
But. Yeah, or in real life. I mean, I feel like, yeah, people are...
Well, so what I thought about this is, so I didn't actually think anybody today is actually going this far, trying to start some war, trying to start some huge, huge quest so that they can be immortal. But I would say that's the logical end for anybody that only thinks or lives as a, you know, a materialistic existence. Like, if this is it, then this is the logical end that some people will eventually start pursuing this, you know?
Okay. That makes sense.
And I think people want to, you know, some people do, but there's just not even technological means yet, you know? There's stuff to stop you from aging, but you're still going to die, right? You know?
Right.
Of course, we've already seen in Lord of the Rings, we've seen Gollum, you know, he actually does this, you know, he gets the long life, you know, even though he's mortal. But as we saw, obviously and famously, long life, quality of life, inverse relationship.
Right.
And even too, we've heard references before, the elves and the Valar, they are immortal, but even they get weary of the world and, you know, sometimes wish to escape it. You know, they envy men that they just get to die and go somewhere else, somewhere cool, you know? So that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, and then, I mean, also, like, this, I was thinking of this word here, besotted. Like, Ar-Pharazôn is, like, basically drunk on Sauron's words, right?
Yeah.
he obviously wants to live forever. He's vain, and he's craving power, and he's afraid, scared of death. But he's just, like, he's drinking it up. Sauron has total control at this point.
Yeah, he's not easily manipulated, not strong. Well, I guess he is kind of strong-willed because he's going along with this, you know. These are bold plans. Anyways, Amandil, he gets wind of Ar-Pharazôn's secret plan to start a war with the Valar and demand immortality. Winning strategy. Obviously, he knows this is going to end badly and this is going to bring ruin upon the world. So he says, therefore, he called his son Elendil, and he said to him, the days are dark, and there is no hope for men, for the faithful are few. Therefore, I am minded to try that counsel which our forefather Eärendil took of old, to sail into the west, be there ban or no, and to speak to the Valar, even to Manwë himself, if may be, and beseech his aid, ere all is lost.
Would you then betray the king? Said Elendil. For you know well the charge that they make against us, that we are traitors and spies, and that until this day it has been false.
If I thought that Manwë needed such a messenger, said Amandil, I would betray the king. For there is but one loyalty from which no man can be absolved in his heart for any cause. But it is for mercy upon men and their deliverance from Sauron the deceiver that I would plead, since some at least have remained faithful. And as for the ban, I will suffer in myself the penalty, lest all my people should become guilty.
But what think you, my father, is like to befall those of your house whom you leave behind when your deed becomes known?
It must not become known, said Amandil. I prepare my going in secret, and I will set sail into the east, whither daily the ships depart from the havens. And thereafter, as wind and chance may allow, I will go about, through south or north, back into the west, and seek what I may find. But you and your folk, my son, I counsel that you should prepare yourselves other ships, and put aboard all such things as your hearts cannot bear to part with. All right, so as you said there, until this point, the faithful have been totally loyal to the king and the Valar, okay? But if Amandil is going to sail to Valinor, like Eärendil did of old, then they will finally have broken their loyalty with the king. To which Amandil said, yep, now's the time. The line exactly is, I would betray the king, for there is but one loyalty from which no man can be absolved in heart for any cause. What do you think about that? Because that line actually struck me, and I got a pretty good historical reference for this. But what do you think first?
I mean, he's basically saying, like, the loyalty to the Valar, or kind of, like, the loyalty to the gods, is it comes first, and you can't walk away from that, even if something worldly seems like it's getting in the way or is conflicting with that.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that there is but one loyalty from which no man can be absolved in his heart for any cause. I think that's beyond the Valar. I think that's to Eru, Iluvatar himself, you know, because I mean, like, and they had the mountain up top where they would worship Eru. So I think the Numenoreans might actually get this. But anyways, what this reminded me of in real life was the St. Thomas More quote. Do you remember, do you know who St. Thomas More is?
I remember the name, but yeah.
Okay, all right. So we know King Henry VIII, he's the one that starts the English Protestant Reformation, right? Mm-hmm. He founds Anglicanism, okay? Because he betrays Catholicism and the Pope because the Pope won't allow him to divorce his wife. Mm-hmm. And so all of England goes along with this plan, or almost all of England goes along with this plan, which is just ridiculous. So even most of the clergy go along with it. So all the bishops of, you know, that were in England or on Great Britain, they all just, they're like, okay, fine, we'll break ranks with Rome and we'll take Henry as the head of our religion. Okay. Mm-hmm. Only two figures of high prominence refuse to do this. One is St. John Fisher, which is the grade school near where I grew up. Mm-hmm. and so he was one of the top bishops of the land, of England. So I don't know if he was in probably the most important bishop of England. And then the other one was St. Thomas More. So Thomas More was the title's chancellor, which is basically, for our purposes, kind of the top counselor, kind of like how Amandil used to be to our Farazan, okay? And so Thomas More doesn't approve of everything, but he really just keeps his mouth shut the whole time. You know, he's really savvy about this, and he's just, okay, you know, I don't approve of this, but I'm not going to have it even, you know, any witnesses say I'm not approving of this, even though they can all tell I don't, right? Mm-hmm. And so this really, really stings Henry VIII because More's approval is the one that he wants most. Because Thomas More, he's been known to be super wise and practical and upright, holy man. Thomas More probably kind of serves as like a physical conscience for the king, kind of like Jiminy Cricket and Pinocchio, you know? Mm-hmm. And so More, he just never gives in to the political pressure, and he doesn't go against his own morals or his own conscience and everything. And so this is most famously seen in, there's a movie about it called The Man for All Seasons, or A Man for All Seasons. It came out in the 60s, but it's still legit. I watched it. It was a pretty good movie.
Okay.
And so anyways, that whole movie just goes over this conflict between Thomas More and Henry VIII. But St. John Fisher ends up getting martyred. St. Thomas More, he's imprisoned, and then eventually he gets martyred too for not becoming Anglican. And so Thomas More, he's publicly beheaded. And his last words to the crowd before they swing the sword to chop off his head, and this really happened. This isn't just some sort of apocryphal line that, you know, Shakespeare adds in later, right? You know, because that's what he did with Julius Caesar, the Et tu, Brute. Nobody actually, he didn't actually say that. But this was real. So Thomas More, when he's about to get his head chopped off, his last lines is, "I die his majesty's," that's the king's, "good servant, but God's first." and then they swing the axe and that's it. I mean, but that when I heard "I would betray the king, for there is but one loyalty from which no man can be absolved in his heart for any cause," I thought of that line, you know. I've read this story probably, I don't know, like 10 times, but it just occurred to me this time as we were going through it, like, oh, that sounds like Thomas More. And you know, stories like this is kind of a common one, but I think this would be the one most common to an English person, especially a Catholic person like Tolkien. And I feel like this either explicitly or at the very least implicitly, this is what he was drawing on, you know, as he's creating Amandil, you know, even though Amandil in the grand scheme of things is kind of a minor character, but I think that's what Tolkien's doing here.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah, kind of cool. Kind of cool reference. It's a great movie. Highly recommend A Man for All Seasons. It was really sweet. Yeah. Should we keep going though?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So, anyways, Amandil, he's going to try to be the second Arendil, but he tells.
By that you mean sailing to Valinor.
and trying to get the help.
The doors of the gods.
Yeah. But he tells Elendil, have everybody be ready to leave and don't do anything the king says if it's about going to war. Just stay out of it, okay? You know, so they get all their ships ready and they're going to do it. What happens to Amandil?
It is said that Amandil set sail in a small ship at night and steered first eastward and then went about and passed into the west. And he took with him 3 servants, dear to his heart, and never again were they heard of by word or sign in this world, nor is there any tale or guess of their fate. Men could not a second time be saved by any such embassy, and for the treason of Numenor, there was no easy absolving.
All right, big bummer.
So, in other words, he just disappears.
Right? Yeah, Numenor's screwed. They don't get. There's no easy way out of this. What about Elendil?
So, Elendil did all that his father had bidden, and his ships lay off the east coast of the land, and the faithful put aboard their wives and their children, and their heirlooms, and great store of goods. Many things there were of beauty and power, such as the Numenorians had contrived in the days of their wisdom, vessels and jewels, and scrolls of lore written in scarlet and black. And 7 stones they had, the gift of the Eldar, but in the ship of Isildur was guarded the young tree, the scion of Nimloth the Fair. Thus Elendil held himself in readiness, and did not meddle in the evil deeds of those days, and ever he looked for a sign that did not come. Then he journeyed in secret to the western shores, and gazed out over the sea, for sorrow and yearning were upon him, and he greatly loved his father. But naught could he descry, save the fleets of Ar-Pharazôn gathering in the havens of the west.
Okay, so that 7 stones that they referenced, do you know what those are?
No.
Oh, there was a whole chapter in Lord of the Rings. Oh, you might not know because you probably don't know how many there are, but those are the Palantiri.
Oh, okay. I did not know that.
So, because there was, I think, 4 in the south and then 3 in the north, but I guess we'll get there at some point. But anyways, they did come from Numenor, so this is the origin of it. I thought I always thought there was a detail in this story. Maybe it's in a different story, or maybe I just missed it, but I thought the elves, that was like the last thing that they brought to Numenor as they were about
to be stones.
Yeah, kicked out, you know, like on their very last trip before all the kings started to really hate them. They did drop off the stones with some people. But anyways, it must have been an elf gift at some point. So because Fëanor, of course, made the 7 stones.
Okay.
So, yeah. Elendil, obedient son, new leader of the faction. Kind of sucks, though, that he takes over when his homeland's in such a tight spot. Doesn't look like there's going to be a good end to the situation, too. Who knows if he's really thinking, like, you know, oh, well, he is ready to leave, I guess, you know.
Yeah, I was going to say, things escalated really quickly for the faithful, right? Like, they went along to, like, basically objecting to the king in spirit only, but never officially, always following along, and now all of a sudden they're readying, like, escape ships off the coast, right?
Sauron's already been having people be sacrificed on,
right.
You know, false grounds, but yeah. Mm-hmm. So yeah, this is rough.
This is their first mobilization, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, most stories, I think we said this last time, but most stories, you got the beginning set up, then the second part's the conflict, and then the third part, you get all the drama resolved. But this story is kind of like the Book of Kings, where, you know, the setup, you have David and Solomon, and it was good. And then it starts to decline, but then at the end, instead of resolving the drama, there is no happy ending. And that, all the kings become so corrupt that God destroys the holy temple in Jerusalem, and all the people are enslaved and brought into exile in Babylon. You know, so similar bad end here. This is what happens. Until now, Numenor, it had always had ideal weather. No more. There's sea storms and occasionally ships sink, and, you know, there's harsh winds and produces rain, difficult sailing conditions and stuff. You want to take some of these weather developments?
Just to clarify, this is like speaking generally, right? This is not like a specific night. This is the weather slowly getting worse.
Well, I think over the course of this generation, but yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And out of the west there would come at times a great cloud in the evening, shaped as it were and as an eagle, with pinions spread to the north and south, and slowly it would loom up, blotting out the sunset, and then uttermost night would fall upon Numenor. And some of the eagles bore lightning beneath their wings, and thunder echoed beneath the sea and cloud. Then men grew afraid. "Behold, the eagles of the lords of the west," they cried. "The eagles of Manwë are come upon Numenor," and they fell upon their faces. Then some few would repent for a season, but others hardened their hearts, and they shook their fists at heaven, saying, "The lords of the west have plotted against us. They strike first. The next blow shall be ours." These words the king himself spoke, but they were devised by Sauron.
All right, so that's pretty wild. So, I mean, you know, you're getting explicit signs from the Valar, just, hey, guys, don't do this. Come on. Mm-hmm. Seriously, shape up, you know.
Right.
But they ain't listening. Lightning strikes start coming on Numenor pretty often, especially around the temple. Sauron actually gets struck by one of them, but he survives, which is pretty badass, actually. Not to say, I mean, he's a Valar, so, or not a Valar, but a Maiar, so makes sense that lightning can't really kill him, but it's still kind of a cool story.
Yeah.
At least half a point in his favor. So, you know, many people wish to deify him on the spot right there after that point. And so it's like, oh, come on, guys. It was cool, but it's not that cool. You know, there's stories on the internet of people surviving lightning strikes, you know. Ar-Pharazôn, he continues building a fleet. He's, what does it say? "In that time, the fleets of the Numenoreans darkened the seas upon the west of the land, and they were an archipelago of 1,000 isles. Their masts were as a forest upon the mountains, and their sails like a brooding cloud, and their banners were golden and black. And all things waited upon the word of Ar-Pharazôn. And Sauron withdrew into the inmost circle of the temple, and men brought him victims to be burned." All right, creepy. So, I mean, yeah.
He's, this like, living off of dead bodies.
Yeah, so that's weird. I was more so focused on the... The ships. Because as evil as these people are, the imagery of this huge fleet is pretty cool in my eyes.
Yeah, I mean,
this is well-written.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it's dreadful imagery, it's still... I don't know, you get the sense of twilight, you know, like everything's darkening, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, and their ships are actually, there's definitely a dark color pattern to them, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What about the counter, though? What's going on?
"Then the eagles of the lords of the west came up out of the dayfall, and they were arrayed as for battle, advancing in a line the end of which diminished beyond sight. And as they came, their wings spread wider than ever, grasping the sky. But the west burned red behind them, and they glowed beneath, as though they were lit with a flame of great anger, so that all Numenor was illuminated as with a smoldering fire. And men looked upon their faces of the fellows, and it seemed to them that they were red with wrath. Then Ar-Pharazôn hardened his heart, and he went abroad with his mighty ship, Alcarandas, Castle of the Sea. Many oared it was, and many masted, golden and sable."
All right, so you're totally right about the Egypt thing, because Ar-Pharazôn hardened his heart. Exodus says that about Pharaoh literally like 20 times.
Okay.
Yeah. So the fleet sets out from Numenor to Valinor at sunset. "Slowly the fleets passed out of sight of the watchers in the havens, and their lights faded, and night took them. And in the morning they were gone. For a wind arose in the east, and it wafted them away. And they broke the ban of the Valar and sailed into forbidden seas, going up with war against the deathless to wrest from them everlasting life within the circles of the world." So the fleet goes all the way. It passes by on both sides of the Lonely Isle because it's so large. Again, just imagining that kind of creepy imagery of, you know, if you're an elf on the Lonely Isle and you just see these, you know, just... fleets, the biggest fleet ever constructed, just pass by you,
right,
clearly
right.
Going to war. I mean, that's nuts, you know. "And at last Ar-Pharazôn came even to Aman, the blessed realm, and the coast of Valinor, and still all was silent, and doom hung by a thread, for Ar-Pharazôn wavered at the end, and almost he turned back. His heart misgave him when he looked upon the soundless shores and saw Tanquetil shining, whiter than snow, colder than death, silent, immutable, terrible as the shadow of the light of Iluvatar. But pride was now his master, and at last he left his ship and strode upon the shore, claiming the land for his own, if none should do battle for it." All right, what do you think of that?
So kind of weird, actually. I was expecting it to be like some epic confrontation here, but it's just deserted. It feels like a trap almost.
Well, it was deserted when Arendelle got there too.
Okay.
And we're going to hear why in a second. But
right.
More so, what do you think of R4 is on?
He clearly is like, you know, he's still human. Like, he does doubt himself at the last second, but then he's all in. He's like, that's the final.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of give him, I'll give him credit that he's got balls to actually go through with this. Mm-hmm. At the very end. But it, you know, that I think it, I mean, it's clearly a sign that, I don't know, almost of his just humanity that, oh man, what did I get myself into? What am I doing here? You know? Right. And what is it that has him go forward? It's pride.
Mm-hmm.
But what held him back originally?
Well, I think it's this. Well, okay, so he's like, the way it's worded, how his heart misgave him when he looked upon the soundless shores, etc., colder than death, silent, immutable. I think he understands, he like, at least I'm interpreting it, he momentarily glimpses the fact that immortality is not going to be what he thinks it is, and it's going to be like something brutal and strange. And he suddenly is like, wait, maybe I don't want that.
You think?
And then, I mean, simultaneously, I think he's also perceiving, like, the power of the gods and realizing that he's about to go to war with the gods.
See, I thought it was partly that he was perceiving the power of the gods, but I thought it was more just, you know, this place is so beautiful. I'm really going to fight against these people. These are really the bad guys. You know, Tanquetil, the whiter than snow, you know, well, colder than death is powerful, but, you know, silent, the immutable, you know, gives off their power and stuff, but still, it's just, I think, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I would almost think, like, yeah, he's doubting himself. He's, what's unclear, and I think this is actually a mistake on Tolkien's part. He should have made this clear. Sauron is not with them here. Mm-hmm. That's another big step, because if Sauron was here, he'd probably, you know, Ar-Pharazôn would probably just be going at it without even, you know, hesitating.
Right.
But
right.
Here he did hesitate. Oh, and the detail wasn't here, so it must be somewhere in the Unfinished Tales, and I can't remember where. But there's this one detail that was so sad, and it stuck with me whenever I had read it. But when he jumps onto the shore, the weapon that he's carrying is the battle axe of Tuor, you know, who's their ancestor, you know, like from, you know, that he used in the fall of Gondolin and stuff. And so Tuor, when he sailed off to the sea, must have left that axe to Eärendil, and he must have left it to Elros, and they passed it on from ancestor to ancestor, because that's the king's weapon. Because Tuor, you know, a battle axe, I mean, that's a kind of a unique thing. Most people use a sword, but he used the axe.
Mm.
And it's just, oh, wow. You know, like, when I heard that detail, and it wasn't here, so I forget where it was. It must be Unfinished Tales or one of the histories of Middle-earth. But it's just, oh, that... It's so sad, because, you know, you're using Tuor's weapon against the Valar, you know, and
yeah.
Obviously Tuor, you know, Olmo appeared to him. He was friends with all of them, you know. I mean, it's just, ugh, how far these people have sunk and fallen. Mm-hmm. It's pretty bad. But yeah, it seems like the Numenoreans, they get here and they set up a beachhead almost.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it says encampment, but yeah, so they actually get a little bit here. You know, it's not like everything just all happens at once, which is kind of how I've usually just read it before. Mm-hmm. I'm usually trucking through it.
Mm-hmm.
Should we start the big finish, though?
Let's do it. Then Manwë upon the mountain called upon Ilúvatar, and for that time the Valar laid down their government of Arda. But Ilúvatar showed forth his power, and he changed the fashion of the world, and a great chasm opened in the sea between Numenor and the Deathless Lands. And the waters flowed down into it, and the noise and smoke of the cataracts went up to heaven, and the world was shaken. And all the fleets of the Numenoreans were drawn down into the abyss, and they were drowned and swallowed up forever. But Ar-Pharazôn, the king, and the mortal warriors that had set foot upon the land of Aman were buried under falling hills. There it is said that they lie imprisoned in the caves of the Forgotten until the last battle and the Day of Doom.
But the land of Aman and Eressëa of the Eldar were taken away and removed beyond the reach of men forever. And Andor, the land of Gift, Numenor of the Kings, Elena of the Star of Arendelle, was utterly destroyed. For it was nigh to the east of the great rift, and its foundations were overturned, and it fell and went down into darkness, and is no more. And there is not now upon earth any place abiding where the memory of a time without evil is preserved. For Iluvatar cast back the great seas west of Middle-earth and the empty lands east of it, and new lands and new seas were made, and the world was diminished. For Valinor and Arisia were taken from it into a realm of hidden things.
In an hour unlooked for by men, this doom befell, on the 9th and 30th day since the passing of the fleets. Then suddenly the fire burst from the metal Tarma, and there came a mighty wind and a tumult of the earth, and the sky reeled and the hills slid, and Numenor went down into the sea, with all its children and its wives and its maidens and its ladies proud, and all its gardens and its halls and its tombs, its towers and its riches, and its jewels and its webs and its things painted and carven, and its lore, they vanished forever. And last of all, the mounting wave, green and cold and plumed with foam, climbed over the land, took to its bosom Tar-Miriel, the queen, fairer than silver or ivory or pearls. Too late she strove to ascend the steep ways of the Menal Tarma to the holy place, for the waters overtook her, and her cry was lost in the roaring of the wind.
All right, big deal. So Iluvatar himself has to intervene. The Valar just, what does it say? The Valar laid down their government of Arda for that time, mm-hmm. you know, because this is just, all right, man, we just sends it up. It's, dude, this is too big for me. I don't know what I'm supposed to do here. Mm-hmm. Iluvatar, step in. You need to do this because this is about...
Or Manwe's just like, Iluvatar, your children are being super annoying.
Well, I think it's because they're demanding immortality. Right. And, you know, the children of Iluvatar are straight from Iluvatar himself. Right. And it's like, this is his stuff, mm-hmm. you know. But, yeah. Big rift in the sea. So it separates off Valinor and the Lonely Isle from the rest of the world, but wherever this rift is, Numenor is really close, so all the violence of, you know, the ocean sinking into it or whatnot, you know, all the lands, you know, on either side of the rift are crumbling, so Numenor is going to crumble in too. Mm-hmm. Now, what did you think of this Ar-Pharazôn's army trapped in the caves of the Forgotten? Wow. So it says imprisoned.
Yeah, it's almost like they're still alive or something like that.
Right. So how ironic would that
be? That's true. That's true that they remain immortal.
Right.
Which could make sense. Like they did set foot in the Undying Land, so maybe that is the case. But I thought it's like kind of funny almost. Iluvatar really doesn't leave any box unchecked. He's like, yeah. Not only did he destroy the entire fleet and Ar-Pharazôn on land, also goes through the trouble to destroy all of Valinor, destroy all of Numenor and just pull it completely underwater.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, casually makes Valinor disappear from the world, removes it into some part of the world that can't be seen or accessed by men, which is pretty confusing. Yeah. But basically,
we'll get some more details on that.
Yeah, too. It's basically like, not only did these guys screw up and they were bad and I destroyed them, but also no, their place has been destroyed, so no more of their people can come, and no men in the future will ever even be able to find Valinor. So mm-hmm. takes care of that issue, basically.
All right, and so what are you picking up from that whole description of the island getting destroyed? What legend is Tolkien trying to make a story for?
Sounds like totally Atlantis or something.
Yeah. Atlantis. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. All right. And then there was also that final big wave that really took out the whole land, even the good queen that couldn't get away. Where have we heard about a wave before? This is pretty tricky. I only have hazy details of it, but.
I don't know.
All right. So if you go all the way back to Frodo's dream at Tom Bombadil's house in the Fellowship of the Ring, he has some dream about the sea. I don't know if it was quite a wave itself, but anyways, Tolkien has, we've mentioned it before because I think I accidentally brought it up maybe too soon, but anyways, Tolkien has this, he had this reoccurring dream of this giant, huge wave just washing over him. And then the weird thing is one of his sons also had the same dream.
Huh.
But anyways, that was a lot of the inspiration, I think, for this story. Like, that was the impetus to really start writing this. Because there were early versions, there was, like, a time travel version of this originally, but there was, and then he just streamlined it into just, it's just part of Middle-earth. No time travel crap, just, it's part of the history, you know? Mm-hmm. But he was definitely trying to, you know, he liked the Atlantis story, but again, it's another one of those things where it's like, how does it fit in, you know? And of course, Atlantis, I think the real thing of Atlantis is just Plato dealt with it, and it was, it's pretty clear that it was probably just some fictional utopia.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not like it ever was ever supposed to exist. But anyways, Tolkien wanted to make a legend for it,
mm-hmm.
you know, just like, yeah, how he did for many other things.
Yeah, and you could, I feel like you could see him working backwards, like, from wanting a story like that to fit it into the whole Silmarillion Lord of the Rings thing. Like, it'd be like, okay, for it to sink under the water, it would have to basically be like smote by the gods, right?
Yeah.
And for it to be smote, the people would have had to do something really, really bad.
Yeah.
So that kind of makes sense, like violating this ban. And then for it to be there in the first place, they probably had to be really, really good. So hence, like, you know, this complete polar opposite over the course of the story.
Yeah. They consider this basically almost a second fall for men. Obviously, it's not all men, but like the Numenoreans themselves, there was the offstage Garden of Eden because he left that possibility open.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was this for the Numenoreans, the main characters of Lord of the Rings, you know.
Mm-hmm. Like,
they fell twice. And I mean, talk about a fall. This is textbook definitions of stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right, so we heard what happened to Ar-Pharazôn and all of his evil men. What about the other people that we know of?
But whether or not it were that Amandil came indeed to Valinor, and Manwë hearkened to his prayer, by grace of the Valar, Elendil and his sons and their people were spared from the ruin of that day. For Elendil had remained in Romena, refusing the summons of the king when he set forth to war, and avoiding the soldiers of Sauron that came to seize him and drag him to the fires of the temple, he went aboard his ship and stood off from the shore, waiting on the time. There he was protected by the land from the great draught of the sea that drew all towards the abyss, and afterwards he was sheltered from the first fury of the storm. But when the devouring wave rolled over the land and Numenor toppled to its fall, then he would have been overwhelmed, and would have deemed it the lesser grief to perish, for no wrench of death could be more bitter than the loss and agony of that day. But the great winds took him, wilder than any that men had known, roaring from the west, and it swept his ships far away, and it rent their sails and snapped their masts, hunting the unhappy men like straws upon the water.
Oh, man. All right, so these are the good guys. So they get a clear run to get away in their ships when this is all starting. But then that wave comes, and that line's crazy. What does it say? But when the devouring wave rolled over the land and Numenor toppled to its fall, then he would, and he is Elendil, then he would have been overwhelmed and would have deemed it a lesser grief to perish. For no wrench of death could be more bitter than the loss and agony of that day.
So in other words, he's ready to give up. He's like, he's just seen his entire homeland, everything he knows, destroyed, and is in the face of some massive storm.
Yeah, like he was the loyal one. And what's the reward for loyalty? The greatest homeland in the world for mortal people just gets destroyed because of all the other people's sins.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like this wave is about to basically wash over his fleet and looks like it's going to destroy it, but instead they get just completely blown.
Yeah, so this is like ultimate shipwreck stories you got. Since we've been making all sorts of references for this, the Aeneid. So that's the one. There's the Iliad and Odyssey, which is the Homer, you know, Greek Trojan War stuff. Mm-hmm. The Iliad's the war, and then the Odyssey is Odysseus' journey home.
Mm-hmm.
The Roman version, which was emulating / trying to outdo them, and was actually written by one person, Virgil, or we know one person, Virgil, when he actually worked on it. He wrote the Aeneid, which is of one Trojan's journey to Italy, where eventually his descendants found Rome. That book opens, there's 10 lines, but then after that, it just jumps right into a pretty epic sea storm, kind of like what they're describing there. So, I mean, you know, if you want to just crack that book open, find a PDF, find an audiobook of it. It just, I mean, there's the 10-line introduction, and then it just jumps right in for like half a chapter of just, oh yeah, we're battling the waves here. I mean, like right in the middle of the story. So it reminded me of this. I mean,
nice.
Rough stuff. I get seasick easily.
Mm-hmm. Same.
Yeah. 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 I'm pretty bad. My face turned green on a tire swing once. I'm not even joking. Apparently it turned green.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. All right. But anyways, these people do manage to land in Middle Earth, but they actually get separated in the, which is no surprise in the storm. So Elendil, he ends up landing in the north, and from there they don't regroup. I don't understand why they don't regroup. He just sets up a kingdom right away called Arnor. And then Isildur and Anarion, they land in the south, and they end up setting up this place called Gondor. I think is how you pronounce it.
Okay.
Though their lore and craft was but an echo of that which had been ere Sauron came to Numenor, yet very great it seemed to the wild men of the world, and much is said in other lore of the deeds of the heirs of Elendil in the age that came after, and of their strife with Sauron that was not yet ended. Alright, so they set up these kingdoms and they still have to battle Sauron, because, obviously, Sauron survives this Atlantis sinking of Numenor as well. Yeah, so he did, like we said, he did not go with Ar-Pharazôn's fleet. He was, I guess the reasoning with on that would probably just be he probably, you know, first of all, he knew that they were going to get destroyed when they went to Valinor. But then he probably also just got out of it because he just said, "Ah, Ar-Pharazôn, you know, you're the big dog. You know, you don't want me there because, you know, it's all about you. You don't want me potentially stealing the thunder. They think I'm a god, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm deified now, so I probably shouldn't go because you're the rock star here. You can do it, you know." But anyways, Sauron was on the island of Numenor when all this cataclysm happened. You want to read what happened to him?
"For Sauron himself was filled with great fear at the wrath of the Valar and the doom that Eru laid upon sea and land. It was greater far by far than aught he had looked for, hoping only for the death of the Numenoreans and the defeat of their proud king. And Sauron, sitting in his black seat in the midst of the temple, had laughed when he heard the trumpets of Ar-Pharazôn sounding for battle. And again he had laughed when he heard the thunder of the storm. And a third time, even as he laughed at his own thought, thinking what he would do now in the world, being rid of the Edain forever, he was taken in the midst of his mirth, and his seat in his temple fell into the abyss. But Sauron was not of mortal flesh, and though he was robbed now of that shape in which he had wrought so great an evil, so that he could never again appear fair to the eyes of men, yet his spirit arose out of the deep and passed as a shadow and a black wind over the sea, and came back to Middle-earth and to Mordor that was his home. There he took upon again his great ring in Barad-dûr, and dwelt there, dark and silent, until he wrought himself a new guise, an image of malice and hatred made visible, and the eye of Sauron the Terrible few could endure."
All right, so that's kind of weird. He might have put his ring aside and kept it safe in his tower when he went to Numenor. That sounds crazy to me, but that might have been what he did.
Yeah.
And so obviously he didn't expect this bad of a reaction. He didn't think this whole island was going to be destroyed or whatever, because he gets stuck into the depths of it, gets his way out because he's a Maiar, so he doesn't really need a physical body if he doesn't want to, right? Mm-hmm. And he travels back to Mordor. But he was so harmed in it that, okay, no more fair appearance, because that's what he had seemed this whole time, mm-hmm. you know, to these people. None of that. You can't hide it. You're a bad guy. You'll always look like an evil person from now on. Nobody, mm-hmm. you're never going to fool anybody again. You know?
Yeah. It seems like that, like, Iluvatar, it's impossible to know if, like, you knew where Sauron was. It makes sense that he would. But then if you actually wanted to destroy Sauron, you should be able to. But he didn't destroy Sauron. But it seems like Sauron was, like, kind of cackling on his throne, but was quickly just, like, destroyed, pulled under, and only barely was able to survive. However, it also sounds like that was kind of his goal. Like, he doesn't sound too much worse for the wear, frankly. Aside from losing this one particular form, he's achieved his goal of getting rid of the Edain.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, he did, but it came at a cost, I would say.
Yeah.
And an unexpected cost, which I think is even more brutal to him because he's so prideful that, you know, he wants to, you know, have everything covered, right? And it's like, oh, shoot, the good guys were even more powerful than I thought. Oops, you know. All right, so at the very, very end of all this, they eventually say that the mountaintop of Numenor, the Menil Tarma, it does eventually reemerge from the sea as a hallowed island because that's where Iluvatar's sacred space had been, you know, and even Sauron actually had not dared to go up it. And so even after all this, still the hearts of the Edain, so the men of the West, the exiles, you know, they turned west and their thought, and, you know, and it was thought if they went to Menil Tarma, they could at least see Valinor and all the other western lands, even though they can't get to it anymore. Now, what does that mean they can't get to it anymore? You want to take this next section?
Yeah. Thus it was that great mariners among them would still search the empty seas, hoping to come upon the Isle of Menil Tarma, and there to see a vision of things that were. But they found it not, and those that sailed far off came only to the new lands, and found them like to the old lands, and subject to death. And those that sailed furthest set but a girdle about the earth, and returned weary at last to the place of their beginning. And they said, all roads are now bent.
All right, you get what's going on?
The entire world has been remade, it sounds like. When Iluvatar pulled Valinor into some sort of hidden space-time and sunk Numenor, it seems like the entire world took on a different shape.
Right. Yeah, so I guess this last paragraph of it gets into it. You want to just take that one too?
Yeah. Thus, in after days, what by the voyages of ships, what by lore and starcraft, the kings of men knew that the world was indeed made round, and yet the Eldar were permitted still to depart and to come to the ancient West and to Avalone if they would. Therefore, the lower masters of men said that a straight road still must be for those that were permitted to find it. And they taught that while the new world fell away, the old road and the path of the memory of the West still went on, as it were a mighty bridge invisible that passed through the air of breath and of flight, which were bent now as the world was bent, and traversed Ilmen which flesh unaided cannot endure, until it came to Tol Eressia, the lonely isle, and maybe even beyond, to Valinor, where the Valar still dwell, and watch the unfolding of the story of the world. And tales and rumors arose along the shores of the sea concerning mariners and men forlorn upon the water who, by some fate or grace or favor of the Valar, had entered in upon the straight way and had seen the face of the world sink below them, and so had come to the lamplit quays of Avalonne, or verily to the last beaches of on the margin of Aman, and there had looked upon the white mountain, dreadful and beautiful, before they died.
Okay, so the world was made round. So now, okay, the world had been flat. Now Valinor and Tol Eressa are removed. So now if you sail west, you just end up in the east, you know? So now we got a globe, I guess.
It sounds like Iluvatar literally, like if the map was like a flat piece of paper, just ripped off the west side of the map that had Valinor on it and then looped the whole thing into a tube almost.
Yeah, there's a little east side as well, but yeah. And then he just took the middle part and made it into a globe.
Like, right,
yeah,
right.
What you're saying. Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty rough, wild. but the elves and anybody that's supposed to find it, there's still just a straight way where they can just go straight across. No men can do it. Well, actually, I don't know. It's really weird if a man ever does, but men really can't.
Well, it suggests that there's rumors that men do, but they still die once they get to the end of this path. They don't actually set foot on the end.
Yeah. But that's what the elves do. That's the straight road. And so, in the context of Lord of the Rings, we hear about all these elves leaving Middle-earth, sailing to the Undying Lands. They can still find the straight way, you know, with their ships. And so that's what they're doing when they leave the Grey Havens. You know, we saw that from the very early chapters of Lord of the Rings. That's what's going on. One of the histories of Middle-earth, I think it's the fifth one, is called The Lost Road. I was kind of confused with it. That was like a time travel story, but I think ultimately what he was trying to progress to was this is the lost road. They can't get to Valinor anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so I don't know. That's a big deal. Talk about when the gods fight, you know, when the Valar get involved and stuff, you know, oh man, the world changes and this is the biggest one of all.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty crazy. I don't know. That's about all I got besides, you know, what's next.
What is next?
We got to see what the exiles do when they get to Middle Earth.
Mm.
We're almost done, too. I think, like, a couple more episodes and then we get back to regular scheduled programming with Return of the King.
Awesome. But awesome.
Couple more things just to catch us up, because now we got what's going to be. We know about Numenor now. Mm-hmm. We know of its glory. We know of its horrible fall. And all its, you know, all its disgusting flaws.
Right, right.
but now, okay, so what are these good men that are left? What do they do when they get back there? We kind of know about the Last Alliance, but what happens in between the Last Alliance and the rest, you know, to Lord of the Rings?
So mm-hmm.
we could do some stuff to cover that. You know, how, you know, there's a certain guy, what's his name? It starts with, like, Aragorn? There's this guy.
Yeah,
Aragorn,
you might have guy? To explain that a little more.
Yeah, he's apparently a king, you know. I mean, we'll see. How did that come to be? You know, that's what we can cover next. So hopefully we can keep it short. Tall order, but I think that was enough for tonight. I think mm-hmm. this is good too. Yeah. If you don't have anything else, Clifford, I'm said we could just end it.
Okay, cool. Thanks, all.
Dude, this PDF, I think it intentionally spells a couple things wrong so that it doesn't look like plagiarism.
Oh, really?
Because it should be unlooked, yeah.
Or it might be like if it was based off of a scan or something. I feel like I've seen it before where like it's like letters that look similar.
Dude, that could be it.
Or it's like it picks up on like R's instead of N's or something.
Mm. Maybe that might make more sense.
You might be right that it's like...
like they just type, they make a random type, or well, a slightly, they make an intentional typo that looks like the real thing, you know? Just, yeah.
But I don't know. Yeah. Okay. In an hour unlooked for by men, this doom befell.